This is podcast number 128. Thank you for joining us at Clinical Conversations, a podcast from JournalWatch, the medical research service whose website is at jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina is also here. The topic this week is diagnostic blood loss, the practice of bleeding people to find out what's ailing them, which in itself can often lead to something called hospital-acquired anemia. Earlier this week, the Archives of Internal Medicine published a survey of diagnostic blood loss among some 18,000 patients with acute myocardial infarction in 57 medical centers. The data were estimated by conservatively calculating volumes of blood drawn for the patient's diagnostic tests. By the end of their stay, one in five patients who were not anemic on admission had developed moderate to severe anemia, that is, hemoglobin levels under 11 grams per deciliter. Dr. Adam Salisbury, the paper's first author, is in the Department of Internal Medicine, Division of Cardiovascular Diseases, at St. Luke's Mid-America Heart and Vascular Institute in Kansas City, Missouri. And Dr. Mikhail Kozobora, the paper's senior author, is also at St. Luke's and is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you for participating. Dr. Kozobora is at a remote meeting in China right now, and so he's called in, and we appreciate the effort. What got you interested in this problem, and why do you think more people haven't thought about this?
This is Dr. Salisbury. We had come across this concern through the process of taking care of patients who present to the hospital with a heart attack, and found that many of these patients developed anemia during the course of their stay. And interestingly, in patients who are admitted with a heart attack, this is often thought to be related to bleeding. And there's been relatively little investigation as to whether other causes of anemia are common in patients with myocardial infarction. And in some of our previous work, we examined the incidence of hospital-acquired anemia at the time of a patient's heart attack in a large 24-center registry of heart attack patients from across the United States, and found that of all patients who came to the hospital without anemia and who are managed with either percutaneous coronary intervention or medical therapy, nearly half of them developed some degree of hospital-acquired anemia, and bleeding was actually relatively uncommon in these patients, such that there was a large number of patients who had no recognized bleeding episodes but still developed anemia during the course of their hospitalization. This prompted us to conduct the present study where we hoped to quantify whether the common practice of diagnostic phlebotomy was a risk factor for development of significant grades of hospital-acquired anemia.
If a unit of blood is about 450 or 500 milliliters, the blood loss in the patients who experienced this anemia was roughly half a unit over the course of their stay in those who got anemia, or about 175 milliliters. And it was only about 80 milliliters in those who didn't. So, you know, the paradox here seems to be that the sicker the patient, that is, the patient who needs more diagnostic testing, the sicker they can become just through the process of investigating the illness.
This is Dr. Kozobora. It is actually somewhat logical that if the patient is sicker, that they would have more blood tests, because, first of all, there may be additional blood work that's needed to figure out what's going on with them, and more importantly, if they're critically ill, if, for example, they're in an intensive care unit, they may need more frequent blood work just for monitoring reasons. So at the same time, these patients also are at the higher risk of developing anemia, not just because they're getting more blood draws, but because the more severe the acute illness is, the more susceptible they are to develop anemia, simply because their bone marrow is not as capable of regenerating red blood cells as the bone marrow of somebody who's less sick, mm-hmm. or a bone marrow of a healthy person. So it's really a combination of things where they require more blood work, and at the same time, they're least capable of compensating for the blood loss, and therefore are most likely to develop anemia in the hospital.
And in your paper, you mention a few ways to reduce the amount of blood removed from a patient in the hospital, such as using pediatric tubes, storing specimens, and obviously reducing unnecessary lab ordering. but do you think also there may be other ways of incorporating cumulative blood loss estimates, for example, into patients' electronic medical record? You know, we live in this very IT-savvy environment whereby you can imagine the ordering of each additional test and the clinician may see a running total. Do you think that could make a difference in, I mean, presumably some of these lab test ordering is probably unnecessary given the amount of variability you found between sites?
Yes, this is Dr. Salisbury. And certainly this could be something that could be incorporated into an electronic medical record to keep a running total of patients' diagnostic blood loss over the course of the stay. And I think the key importance of tracking this information would be that there are very common sense strategies to reducing diagnostic blood loss. We found in our paper that when we did a simulation, assuming that pediatric tubes were used for all blood draws, that we could substantially reduce the amount of blood that was drawn over the course of a patient's hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And this is also consistent with the finding that many hospitals use larger tubes for adult draws than are absolutely required for their analytic equipment. There are also other strategies that can be employed very commonly, such as using stored serum samples. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if a patient is in the hospital and has multiple services consulting, adding additional lab tests to an earlier stored serum sample is likely to be a very effective strategy to reduce diagnostic blood loss. And, of course, as you mentioned, simply thinking critically about whether these blood tests are really needed is an important step for the physician to take, and maybe greater awareness of the importance of diagnostic blood loss and a patient's cumulative exposure to phlebotomy could prompt more thoughtful approaches from physicians.
So it may be an oversimplification, as you mentioned. You know, just the it may not be as simple as it sounds for medical centers or other outpatient labs to adopt, you know, universally adopt pediatric tubes, because it sounds like it would also require, you know, changing over some of their analytic tools as well. Is that accurate?
In most labs, some of these smaller pediatric tubes can actually be used on standard adult analytic equipment. Mm-hmm. That's certainly something that we've found on discussing these issues with our laboratory at St. Luke's Hospital, is that often 2-milliliter tubes mm-hmm. can be used in place of 4 and 6-milliliter tubes without any changes to the standard equipment.
So why do you think that that hasn't been universally adopted? Do you think we're just sort of slow on the uptake, or do you think there's other barriers?
And Dr. Kosaboro may want to comment on this as well, but I think one of the major barriers is simply not realizing how the magnitude of patients' cumulative blood losses mm-hmm. add up over the course of a long and complicated hospitalization. And the second is the consideration that many MI patients do not have normal hematopoietic reserve. Mm-hmm. So they often have renal disease and heart failure and other conditions that are strongly tied to anemia, such mm-hmm. that even minor blood losses can be very important since they're not able to mount a normal response to the bleeding or to a loss of blood from phlebotomy.
As Dr. Kosaboro, I just wanted to add to the excellent comments that Adam made, which is part of the reasons why not everyone is using pediatric tubes or smaller tubes universally on every patient is I think up to now really has been relative lack of awareness that it's really, really important. Physicians clearly know that drawing blood is necessary to make the diagnosis and to follow the patient, make sure the patient's stable, and there has been somewhat of a, I think, underappreciation that there may be a downside to drawing more blood. And if there is no downside, then there is no real impetus to change practice and to try to put a lot of effort into blood conservation. Now, I think, you know, this paper is one of the things that we hope is going to highlight the fact that, you know, the amount of blood that we draw is really important. And once physicians and nurses realize that it's really important, then that provides a push to actually change practice. I mean, I can tell you that in some really high-risk patients, this has been more universally accepted. For example, patients with hematologic malignancies that require frequent blood draws and at the same time at very high risk for developing anemia because of chemotherapy that they receive. In those types of patients, very common to use pediatric tubes because there is realization by physicians and nurses how important it is to conserve blood. But I think, you know, what we show is that this applies much more broadly. And while we did our study on patients with heart attacks, it's very likely the very, very similar picture actually exists in patients admitted to hospital with other disease conditions. And since this practice of using smaller tubes is not associated with any significant increase in cost, and there is really very little downside to using smaller tubes because in most hospitals, the equipment is perfectly capable of analyzing smaller tube samples, as Adam mentioned. I think that really should be one of the things that hopefully will direct physicians and nurses to pay attention to how much blood we draw and to actually start using these smaller tubes more universally.
Just like you said, even though the patient population that you studied was acute MI, I mean, clearly this can be widely applicable to other diagnoses throughout hospital systems.
Yeah, this is Dr. Salisbury, and we absolutely agree. We don't think that there is anything that's unique about myocardial infarction patients. We are obviously cardiologists, and these are the populations that we study, mm-hmm. but it's quite likely that the patients who are presenting to the hospital with other medical illnesses or even for surgical procedures who have prolonged, complicated hospitalization mm-hmm. Likely also experience large diagnostic blood loss and would also be excellent targets for hospital-based changes to their existing processes of care to limit the amount of phlebotomy that occurs for these patients.
The only other question was, you know, obviously you found quite a bit of variability among the different hospitals in the amount of blood loss, and presumably the patient population was not terribly different from one hospital to another. And so what other things are factoring into all this variability?
This is Dr. Salisbury. So there are significant variability in our study in the amount of diagnostic blood loss between hospitals. We actually did adjust these values for the size of the hospital mm-hmm. and the amount of MI patients that were enrolled from that center. Certainly, there could be some differences in the acuity of the patients who are admitted to those hospitals and the comorbidity and disease burden. But we think it's also likely that there are substantial variations in the analytic equipment that's used in the labs and in hospitals' processes of care with relation to the amount of blood that's drawn, the size of the tubes that are used during the course of their stay, and whether they do utilize stored serum samples. So it's likely that some of this variability reflects that there are differences in hospital-based processes of care. And it's hopeful that with standardization and greater realization of the importance of diagnostic phlebotomy as a risk factor for anemia, that there can be a minimization of the variability across hospitals.
I know that the paper only appeared last week, but have you had any reactions from colleagues about this? A colleague of mine said, every intern knows this, but nobody has ever done anything about it. So have any colleagues approached you?
This is Dr. Costa Barrett. I can say that actually I've had several discussions with my colleagues here in our cardiology practice, and the reaction I received mostly was the fact that while there might have been a suspicion that that is the case, the degree with which phlebotomy volume was associated with developing new anemia was somewhat of a surprise, the magnitude of that association. And, I think the physicians were, in general, somewhat surprised to see that it's such a strong risk factor. And, as I said, realization that there is really a downside to how much blood we draw. And I think that is probably one of the most important impacts of the study, is to make people aware that there is a downside, and hopefully that will be an impetus to change practice. In fact, I can tell you that Dr. Salisbury and I are working very hard to try to implement such a change at our own institution so that we minimize the volume of blood and hopefully reduce actually the volume of blood that's drawn at our institution on average per patient, reduce the number of patients that develop anemia in the hospital, and hopefully improve patient outcomes longer term. But I think that, you know, maybe at some institutions, there is more of an awareness that that is the case. But I think my guess would be, in general, that people are not quite, are not nearly as aware that this is a problem as we might think.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Salisbury and Dr. Kasabarad, for talking with us today. This is, we'll look forward to your further studies in this area.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was number 128. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adoriano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, please. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thank you for listening.